The year was 1987. Megalomaniacal Uber-puppets had infiltrated municipal government in scores of cities and towns throughout the United States. Originally from Berlin and Dresden, these wire-optical super-sentient marionettes had had themselves appointed mayors, managers, morticians, and municipal mummers. In such positions of power, they gradually subjugated the human citizenry of the communities that they oversaw. At certain celebratory events, they even ate them.
Ate what, the events?
Exactly. Resistance, though organized, was futile. But as suddenly as they had risen to power, the Uber puppets just as precipitously disappeared. One day, they were herding any resident over 18 inches in height into labor camps to manufacture motorcycle airbags. The next day, the entire area was devoid of all nettling, non-flesh-and-blood life. A research scientist named Ruby Primavera...
Ruby! This must be related to some of those other folks.
Maybe so.
Ruby!
Postulated that they were somehow related to the brood 10 cicadas and had simply entered the nymph stage of their life cycles. That meant they had gone underground to snack on tree and shrub roots for a span of 17 years. Primavera's theory was loudly ridiculed by the scientific community, at least until last week, 17 years to the day after the marionettes vanished, when the Uber puppets abruptly returned. They didn't attempt to regain control of local government right away because their sex drives had also awakened. And after a decade and 7/10 of inactivity, they were decidedly randy. But they didn't limit their amorous trolling to their own kind. It seemed that any old puppet would do. Bunraku puppets, hand puppets, shadow puppets, string puppets, animatronic puppets, Japanese sashimi puppets, pottle twin bobbleheads, all were fair game for the overly libidinous Uber puppets. However, most observers opined that it was only a matter of time before their lustful desires were sated and they reverted to their autocratic ways. Fortunately, research scientist Primavera had prepared for this day. In the years since she had last encountered the mighty marionettes, she had taken several courses in puppetology from the University of Hamakon Smarth in southwesternmost Lincolnshire, had in fact graduated cum laudanum with a degree in supermarionation. Yes, there was even a technical term for the likes of Uber puppets. According to Ruby's thesis, there was really no stopping these self-aggrandizing demon dolls once they started scheduling meetings, collecting delinquent taxes, and hiring and firing and devouring municipal employees. The Uber puppets were immune to pesticides. They were decidedly unpalatable. They wouldn't listen to reason, or at least to humankind's version of reason. They did, however, listen to their circadian cousins. The males, anyway, as they furiously rubbed their resonating organs in an attempt to attract the goyles.
The goyles! Ruby!
The brood 10's noisy cheering clearly stimulated the puppet's own libidos, as evidenced by acts of sexual gratification too perverse to be described here. Thus, Ruby hypothesized, to exclude them from Uber puppet government, they merely had to be concupiscently engaged.
Concupiscently,
yes, I knew that.
Concupiscently engaged. Favorite kind.
Until the urge to head underground for another 17 years kicked in. As luck would have it.
Luck is always in these essays.
Ooh-hoo. The Boy and Girl Scouts were at the time preparing to launch their annual bottle drives, in which they hit up homes nationwide for returnable for deposit cans and bottles. Somehow, Ruby convinced them to collect cicadas instead this year. And collect they did, by the tractor trailer load. Especially in the beleaguered Ohio Valley and Central Atlantic seaboard regions, where the insects congregated in uncountable numbers, residents were only too happy to part with their cicadas. Then, from the distribution centers somewhere in Vermont, Ruby FedExed the trillions of trilling insects to every municipality that had a history of Eber puppets.
Eber puppets.
The result was largely unnoticed by anyone unfamiliar with the threat. Local government merely continued to function in a reasonable manner, uninterrupted by the dictates of despotic marionettes. And then, after a tense 3 weeks of waiting, both cicadas and
Uber puppets,
responding to some unknown command from a neutron star in the Crab Nebula.
That Crab Nebula?
Yeah.
That's the wrong place.
It is?
Yeah.
Where should it... The Puppet Nebula?
Yeah, the Cicada Nebula.
Well, I thought there's an...
Circadian Nebula, maybe.
There's an arthropodic...
Arthropodic?
Arthropodic...
Arthroprosthetic?
Connection.
Arthur's prosthetic? What are you talking about
Arthur's.
Here? Circadian rhythms, all right.
Anyway, from that neutron star, cycled into the next phase of their lives and headed underground for another 17-year nap. Government officials were eager to put the Uber puppet problem behind them, but Ruby insisted that it shouldn't simply be left for the next generation to solve. After much cajoling, she finally persuaded the United States Congress to institute a sweeping import tax on marionettes to curb the influx of any more Uber puppets. In honor of America's most insidious Uber puppet, it was called the Howdy Doody. Sort of a deconstructed theme song?
Yes, of course.
Wow. The duty of this 468th episode of Calvis and Damien's Numismatic Bazaar is to prepare you, our listening audience, for another evocative interview event with a composer from the Valencia Burbs, a preparatory task already peremptorily prepared by Calvis. Oh.
Yes, I knew you'd love it.
Yes, that's what I get for sending the essay just about an hour earlier.
Yes, just enough time to look up every online version of the Howdy Doody theme song.
So that's what they were all versions?
All versions, yes.
Wow.
The five of them.
Wow.
Including one MIDI version that I recontextualized myself.
Ooh.
Yes. Okay, well.
And we do have nearly cicadas on the other track.
Yes, we have a piece by Richard Zafonar, who is our guest on Calvis and Damien. This is his piece called Fricket, a piece that we first heard as part of...
The Dream Room
at the Ottawa Festival in 2001 in Montpelier. Let's listen to the last minute of it, then we'll be back to tell you why. Thank you.
Cricket Richard Zvonar's creation from crickets and tree frogs and other things of the like.
I'll have you know, this recording was taken to Antarctica last year by an acquaintance who liked it so much.
Oh, wonderful. Excellent. Well, Cricket's only available from Calvos and Damien on our website, or from Richard Zvonar, who I'm sure will be happy to send you a stereo version or a multi-channel version, because the original is 8 channels.
Yes, it was quite astounding to go into the dream room with surrounded by these crickets and frogs and such. It was very wonderful.
About as circadian as you're going to get on Calvus and Damien. Of course, a Howdy Doody mix in there. Richard Zvonar, our guest today. It's a long interview, and he doesn't actually interrupt it at any point but I do. So I've got it all chopped up into little bits so we can play some of Richard Zvonar's music. Do we have any news this week? Do we have anything to say?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I was Ethel'd last week, but that's... Oh, I was Ethel'd.
32.5%
A little then. But they're in Groningen right now.
What are they doing in Groningen?
Playing.
Are they playing your tune?
No. Oh, I don't think so. I don't know.
Didn't they like it?
I have to make some modifications to the score.
What?
I have to put, instead of quarter note equals 60, quarter note equals Ethel.
Yes, that would probably do. And you're being played in Carnegie Hall in September. I just found that out.
Well, it happens.
Yes, some piece of yours called Urban Renewals.
Right.
For orchestra.
Right, youth orchestra, and we're all going down in a bus.
In a bus?
In a bus.
You're all going down in a bus. Well, I'm having my piece Ice Cut done that day, and... with the Vermont Symphony Orchestra here in Vermont. So there's a little competition going on there. Can't have that.
No.
Okay. Well, where are we?
Mr. Zvonar.
Interview with Richard Zvonar, which I have here somewhere. There it is. And we'll have a few interruptions for some of his music. But beyond that, not much. So shall we go right there?
Because
that'll give us
some
time at the end of the show to play maybe some other tunes if there's any time left.
What fun. Or more crickets.
More crickets, yes. All right, out to beautiful downtown Valencia Burbs, the office of Anne LeBaron.
Did I see air quotes around beautiful downtown? No.
Well, no, my hand was on the knob.
Oh, okay.
You heard, what are they, vanilla fudge quotes.
Ooh.
Let's put it that way. Here's some.
Are we yet on the road?
We are on the road, once again.
Again, it's another day, another road. And all the road lead to Richard Zvonar.
Here on Calvos and Damien. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Oh, we are glad you said that, because there have been some who've not been so glad. But if you're glad, then that makes everything starting.
Make us all beaming.
If I wasn't here, I'd be home. And, you know, I know what that's like.
You live nearby.
Yeah.
Well, we're fascinated by your stuff, by your humor. This is one of the things that I like, because you have a good sense of not only the ironic but also the funny in your work. And so give us your bio. You've done some amazing stuff.
Okay. I think musically speaking, if we want a musical bio, we have to go back to my childhood.
Well,
naturally.
Sure.
And I grew up in New Jersey. Originally in Union, right near Route 22.
Why, that's where Harmony House was.
Really?
In what town? The record company in Union.
In Union?
Yes, it was. On Route 22. Right next to the Dairy Queen.
I don't remember that. I remember, the flagship.
Yes, it was just down the road from
And the Peter Pan Diner.
Yes, you could practically see it.
House of Tile, or World of Tile, I think it
Don't
was.
Don't recall the World of Tile. Yeah. I never went tiling.
Yeah, well, Route 22 is one of the great treasures of the northeastern highway system.
Yes.
It's got the worst road surface you can imagine.
Absolutely.
And traffic is coming at you from both sides, because there's a center median full of things. The flagship I mentioned was originally a nightclub and restaurant in the shape of an ocean liner.
Right. Well, Route 22 was where, on the very first day of driver education, that's where they took us.
Oy.
I still remember that truck horn to this day as I pulled out.
Yeah. Well, by the time I was doing drivers, they were living in Summit, so Route 22 was where I had to go for my driving test. So by then I'd been on 24 and all the other little byways, but yeah, and 22 is the acid test.
This was part of your musical upbringing too, because
I'm sure. Probably before I became actively involved in music, I was actively involved in making mouth noises as part of my play. And since I was into science fiction, probably my first approach to any kind of electronic or electroacoustic sounds was, you know, making laser guns and, well, they didn't have lasers, but, you know, disintegrators and flying saucers and all that sort of thing. So, but my earliest actual music, aside from the William Tell Overture and you know, such things that were soundtrack music from the TV, was mostly novelty records. When I really started getting into it, and actually my first experiments with tape was trying to replicate the Chipmunk song. You know, you remember?
Sure.
Christmas, Christmas. You know that?
Yeah, Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Yeah, David Seville. Ross Bogdasarian, I think, was his actual name. And that was all tape speed manipulation. So, you know, a friend had a tape recorder, and we would do that sort of thing. But that really didn't lead naturally to anything more avant-garde. I didn't really get into anything avant-garde until much later. My earliest interests were little kid pop music and then teenage pop music. Still a lot of it in the realm of novelty tunes. And my first approaches to composition were actually song parodies. So, for instance, when I was in the Boy Scouts, we were all very cruel, and there was one guy in the troop that we'd like to poke fun at, so I did a version of Alley Oop called Fitzy Oop, because the guy's name was Harold Fitzgerald, and it was quite mean. But, you know, that was how I started. And, in fact, I would say that that provides kind of a ground for a lot of work since, because I've very commonly taken pre-existing material of some sort and recontextualized. So all of these kind of highfalutin, you know, semiotic and constructivist and deconstruction, all this hoo-ha, is really something that came out of my play practice. And then when I discovered that people were intellectually involved in that sort of thing, well, of course,
well, you just redefined it, and there you were.
Yeah.
Astounding.
So then as far as any real music, I like to sing, and I did a little bit of choral singing, especially, you know, little musicales as part of the school thing. I also took trumpet lessons. I was miserable at the trumpet, and I really hated it. I thought it would be a great fun thing, but I didn't count on how hard it is to learn to play the trumpet. Just to make a decent sound is difficult. Yep. You know, it's one of those things that you have to have really indulgent family.
Yes.
And yes. I hated it so much that at one point I stuffed a piece of cotton wool down the bell and so it wouldn't play. And then I got scared, so I tried to get it out, and I couldn't fish it out, so I tried to blow it up with a firecracker.
Oh.
And that didn't work, so then I hid it behind the couch and told my parents that I couldn't find it.
Was that the end of the trumpet?
Well, yeah, they finally took it into the shop and fished out the stuff. And so I didn't attempt to play another instrument until I actually finished high school, and I had friends who had bands in high school, and I really wanted to be in a band, but I didn't play anything. And I tried to sing in the band, but I wasn't a very good singer either. And finally, after high school, I bought a guitar. Like the day after graduation, I went down to the local shop, bought a secondhand harmony guitar. It was such a bad guitar, it took two fingers to make a bar, you know, for bar chords. And I bought a Mel Bay. It was supposed to be an easy guitar method.
Yeah.
And those things, you have to make these chords that, you know, stretch out over about five frets, and that was no good. So I used my mother's easy organ books, and by the end of the summer, I had learned the chords to four songs. But they were all in the wrong keys for guitar. They were all in flat keys because of their keyboard. So that was when I learned to transpose. And that was the summer of '63, And as everyone knows, in January, or I guess February 9th, was when the Beatles first appeared on Ed Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan, yes.
And from that point on, I got serious about the guitar and got serious about wanting to perform. And that led into a number of years playing in rock bands.
It's amazing that people don't realize that in many of the movies, particularly that the Beatles made, you're really George.
The
I always like that one.
Yes.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
Flagship.
Of the Non-Pop International Network. Always happy to say that. Nonpopradio.com. Or you can go directly to us at calvos.org.
Say, did this show commence our 10th year?
No.
No.
Next year. Next week.
Next week.
Next
Never
week,
mind.
Yes, next week we begin the first show of year 10. And year last.
Probably, unless someone steps forward with gobs, buckets of cash.
Or maybe year 9 will be the last, you never know, between now and next week.
Oh, right.
Know what might happen. Oh, we have lots of things happening. Actually, next week we're going to have some folks in the studio with us, just sort of watching us work.
Oh,
we have
yes.
A crew from the Discovery Channel will be here, and they just love us. They want to see what we're doing.
Want to discover something.
Discover a few things.
Well, that's because you're being featured.
I'm being featured, yes, but that won't be happen until probably the fall. Mm-hmm. When the program is all edited.
This is not fall as in decline in fall.
Maybe that, but they certainly are. They're giving me free plane tickets, which I do like. free tickets to Slovakia.
Plus
so.
they follow you as you pontificate over this dead
Absolutely.
Relative.
Absolutely, I pontificate, and plus we're doing a rehearsal of the opera, and you're going to be playing bowed gong. And
wait, there's no bow in there. It's all tap. It's tap and strike.
And bow. The long notes.
It doesn't say bow.
I'll write it in crayon.
Fine.
Oh, gosh. What we heard, by the way, before the station ID.
I guess I should practice.
You should. Is the Diablo variations of Richard Zavonar. And it's another private release. Everything you'll hear today will be private releases of Richard Zavonar. So let's get back to that interview, and we'll talk about Boeing in the meantime.
Criminy. That didn't go anywhere.
Screwed.
So.
Oh, you're trying to do your Conan O'Brien imitation here? Yeah. Jokes that don't work?
Don't his work?
Okay.
Well.
So where were you playing in these bands? Were you still in New Jersey at the time?
No, I started college in 63. I went to MIT, Cambridge, Mass. I was under the delusion that I was going to become an astronautical engineer. So I was in the course 16, aeronautics and astronautics at MIT. Mm. And I found that by my sophomore year, I was spending a lot more time playing the guitar than actually doing my physics homework. And
well, that probably didn't make you terribly unusual, but
yeah. Well, I was somewhat unusual then. It wasn't until a year or two later. I mean, I was sort of one of the first baby boomers in my class, and so I was also one of the first dropouts, and. The way I got actually into playing in bands was we had a co-op program with aeronautics and astronautics where you could go work in industry for a semester. Mm-hmm. And I came to L.A. and I worked at Douglas Aircraft Company in Long Beach in 1965.
Wow.
Now, the first couple of days I was in the area, I was staying in a hotel on the beach in Santa Monica. And I discovered a place called Ace Loans that was a little mom-and-pop pawn shop.
Oh, no.
And their sons were into music, and they were selling guitars. So I put down a deposit on an electric guitar, and my first paycheck, I bought it. And I met a bass player and a drummer, and we started a band. And so my very first gigs were actually playing around in the L.A. area. And then when I went back to Cambridge, I, after a few months, hooked up with a band that became serious and actually did recording, played all over New England, put an album out in 68. And
we know you, the band, as?
Ill Wind. Not to be confused with the Ill Wind Ensemble.
Different group.
They're
really.
A nice not, bunch of fellows, but they stole our name.
Not a rock and roll band either.
No, not at all. So, was in that band. We put out an album that didn't do very well at all, but now you can buy one on eBay for more than $100 if it's
original. And you have a closet full, and that's your income now.
I wish I did. I have a bunch of ratty old copies of it. It's also been reissued about 3 times in both vinyl and CD. So that was my outing in rock and roll. After that band, I was in a few more groups.
And was that kind of the end of your career as a scientist?
Yeah. What happened was I dropped out of MIT in 67, and then it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll for a couple of years, and then I dropped back in for 1 year to finish. And at that time, they had just begun to have film classes, and I enrolled in the film class. So I started making 16-millimeter films, little black and white films, and the first of those that I did was actually sort of a early rock video, and I took some music and I cut visual on the beat and all that. So that would have been 69. That was the same period of time that I saw Merce Cunningham and met John Cage and Gordon Mumma. It turned out my film teacher was asked by Merce Cunningham to film one of their dances that was under development. This was sort of a preview mini tour through New England before they did something at Brooklyn Academy of Music in January. So they're working on this piece, Tread, which was a kind of interesting piece. They had a bunch of these big pole fans, big floor fans, across the front of the stage. And I went along to tape a reference track, and Ricky Leacock, who was my film teacher, and another student did a two-camera shoot. It was before video.
Mm-hmm. Right, sure.
I mean, the only video recording was, you know, big one-inch machines in studios, so you didn't have portapacks.
No, that preceded the portapacks by 2-3 years.
Yeah. So I went to this dance concert at UMass Amherst and met Gordon Mumma after the gig, and they did another one in Boston. I went to that, and then they also did an event at Project MAC, which was the artificial intelligence project at MIT, and it was the first interactive computer music I ever saw. They did a program with Gordon's piece Hornpipe, which he has this little thing he called the Cybersonic
Console.
Yeah,
I remember this, yeah.
And he would play French horn. Mm-hmm. And it would monitor the resonances of the room, and then after it had collected enough material on the resonant profile of the room, it would start to produce its own tones. Then there was a comparable project with Gordon on musical saw and a mainframe computer. So the computer was taking input from the saw and doing a similar sort of thing, doing an analysis and then producing a variety of digital sounds. So that was very inspiring to me. I was already by that time educating myself about electronic music. In those days, there wasn't a lot of in the ambient culture, there wasn't a lot of knowledge about electronic music. You know, you'd hear little bits of things on TV commercials, film soundtracks. But you didn't really know what it was.
No, as a matter of fact, isn't that was the time when John Appleton did his, was it New York Airport Rock or San Francisco, the one in 1969 where he went around in the airport waiting area and asked people what they thought of the new electronic music. And it was really, and then he made a collage of those responses, and they were just terribly funny because no one had a clue what it meant. And then he repeated the effort in 1999, and no one had a clue.
Yeah, so by 69, I had already been listening to a lot of records. You know, before we sort of rolled disc, we were talking about the Gesang der Jünglinge, yeah, the Deutsche Grammophon recording. That and Contacta were right on a disc. That was one of my first ones. The reason I knew about Stockhausen is on the second Who album, there was a little short bio blurb of Pete Townsend where he said he liked Stockhausen.
I said, oh,
okay. And I heard that the Beatles were listening to John Cage, you know. So I'd go out and I'd find these people. I'd buy the record, read the liner notes.
Oh, yeah.
And that was it. So by 69, I'd been listening to these things for a few years. The Mothers, you know, Frank Zappa was another.
Sure.
That was the first time I ever heard of Edgar Varèse, was that he was quoted, you know, the modern-day composer refuses to die or some such thing on the first Mothers album, the Freakout album. So I was primed, and I was making films in my film class. So one of my early films was for four tape recorders, spatially separated in the corners of the room, each with its own individual tape and its own operator and a film. And the soundtrack consisted of a variety of things, things I'd recorded off, you know, Dial a Prayer, that sort of thing. William Burroughs' Towers Open Fire soundtrack, you know, clips of that, people talking, this and that. So I did my first tape manipulation with a Nagra and a Tandberg tape deck. So those were what were available in the film studio.
Handsome couple of tape decks.
Yeah. And I developed some techniques, just sort of figured things out. Well, if I pull this lever here, it'll go from fast forward to rewind, and you'll be able to hear it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was doing all these whoopy things, and the Tandberg had a little clutch that would grab the tape and stop and start it instantly, and if you did that on the playback deck while you were recording onto the other, you'd get all of these pyong kind of effects. Mm-hmm. So that was my first tape music. And then I played around with MagnaSync dubbers. That was my first multi-track tape manipulation where, you know, MagnaSyncs are these things that use 16-millimeter sprocketed tape. It used to be the standard of the industry before digital came in. And we had a rank of three of these things that we'd use for doing film sound mixing. We also had a Langevin graphic EQ, and you know, so that was my early education in that. So by the mid-70s, I was living in California. I'd moved out in 74, and I worked on a for
you
about
moved
a,
out now as a performer.
Well,
you had a day job at the time.
No, I really haven't had day jobs.
No good.
I was living in Cambridge, Mass, still trying to make a go of it playing on the rock scene, but the scene had changed and it just wasn't going anywhere. So I just decided to hang it up. And a friend of mine I knew from the film classes at MIT was living in Palo Alto. He had been out briefly from Stanford to do the film study and gone back to finish his degree, and he'd written a script. And he was from a prosperous milieu, and he raised some money, $1,000 here, $500 there. So he had a modest budget to do an independent feature. So I spent a year working on this feature, which was called Off the Wall. It was a 16-millimeter black and white, quite interesting film. Written and directed by Rick King, who's now a script doctor and director for hire around town. But this was, you know, his first feature. So we spent a year on that, after which I was completely exhausted and completely broke, and I moved to Santa Cruz to mellow out. And the very week I moved to Santa Cruz, the Cabrillo Music Festival was in full swing, and they had a new music concert featuring four percussion canons by Jim Tenney. And I went out to attend the concert, talked to some people there who said, yeah, the music department here is really great, and registration's Monday. So on Monday, I went in and decided to register for a few classes and then drop the ones that I didn't like. I ended up adding more. I ended up as a full-time student. And among the courses I took were recording and audio systems, and there was a new music ensemble. So my first official new music composition was a septet for voices in which no vowel sounds are produced. It was sort of vocal noise. It was influenced by Pauline Oliveros' sound patterns. Yeah. And it used a graphic score, graph paper with a lot of squiggly lines and symbols from the International Phonetic Alphabet. And it was conducted by a large clock that I borrowed from the phys ed department from the pool. And I also used a projector. So that was my first sort of multimedia theater piece. It's called Chanson des Muets, which is Song of the Mutes.
How was it received?
Well, again, it's one of those pieces that demonstrates some humor. I mean, you have got all these people who are going, you know.
Yeah. That's right.
But very formally, you know, performed. And, you know, if I'd had tails available, I would have worn them. So during that period of a couple of years in this community college, Cabrillo College, I was active with the New Music Ensemble, did a number of pieces. We did concerts quite regularly. A friend of mine, Bob Beatty, was teaching the audio courses, and he started an electronic music class, and he had a Buchla music easel. So I started doing electronic or electroacoustic performance. We'd set up a couple of four-track tape decks with the old time lag accumulator patch, the Terry Riley thing that was later appropriated by Robert Fripp and renamed Frippertronics, but it was actually Terry's thing. And so, you know, there I was, very active in new music, living on very little because, you know, Santa Cruz is a place with a lot of young people and very few jobs. You know, it has a couple of colleges and so on. And I started thinking towards the future and what am I going to do after I've taken all the music classes. And I decided to apply to Mills College. And I wasn't sure I would get in, so I figured I better have a backup. So I also applied to UC San Diego. Well, Mills took their sweet time about telling me if I was in or not. In the meantime, I'd been offered a Regents Fellowship by UC San Diego, so I decided to go there. And I was really scared to death because, you know, I didn't have any particular background in classical music. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could read and write music, but just barely, you know. And I didn't have a performance proficiency on any instrument. My guitar didn't count, you know. That was strictly rock and roll guitar.
That's right.
You know, I could do classical singing to a certain extent, but I was going there as a composer. But as soon as you show up, they start giving you tests, you know, proficiency tests, and I flunked all of them. But in any case, I was able to produce some pieces. The first piece I did there was a piece made out of vocal sounds, choral sound masses. I was very into Penderecki and Ligeti and that sort of thing at the time. So I used some material I'd recorded at Cabrillo and did a lot of music concrete manipulation. Did some instrumental pieces, and then a CD I've just given you, a piece for percussion and tape, was my master's piece. And that ended up taking me a whole school year to complete.
What's the name of that piece?
That's 3 for 5.
Okay.
That's a tip of the hat to Pauline. That's kind of a Pauline title. You know, it's like 1 of 4, that sort of thing.
Oh, and now we can. always tell me. We are such fools, we must enslave and we must own. And now we can't go and talk by the sea anymore. Can't even walk by the sea anymore. They are gone now. You never know when they're around.
You never know what you're going to hear on Calvus and Damien. War with the Newts. Richard Zavonar, composer of that. That's on a private CD of the group Clang. The actual people involved are not identified. On
We've heard that before.
Yes. That's right. Before that, the last cut we heard was his trio, string trio. Always fun. You never know. Shall we
back to Valencia.
Move along? Here we go. Back to Richard Zavonar. Oh, my goodness.
That was written in collaboration with Daryl Pratt, who's an excellent percussionist now based in Sydney, Australia. And it was a piece for four-track tape. All of the sounds were manipulated or else not. You know, some of them were straight percussion sounds. Some of them were heavily transformed percussion sound. The idea being to create a kind of continuum between the live sound and the recorded sound. In some cases, they would match very closely. In other cases, there'd be quite a difference. Following in the
contacto.
I mean, it's that sort of approach. Except not using synthetically generated sounds, but recorded material. So that was a big piece, three movements. Wood instruments, mainly marimba and temple blocks in the first. Second movement was three amplified timpani used primarily as resonators mm-hmm. for other instruments, so bowed cymbal, spun crotales, you know, various things. And then the third movement was metallophones centered on the vibraphone and some chimes and gongs and this and that. I then got a bit stalled trying to do a big piano piece, and it took me much too long to accomplish something that I really wasn't that into. And the piece was called PFT 88, and it was intended to be a theater piece in which the pianist was actually an automaton. So it was inspired by Conlon Nancarrow, and it was intended to be very much like Nancarrow's music played by a human robot at the keyboard. But instead of focusing on the theatrical aspect of it, I got really hung up in a kind of theoretical, generative process of... I created this matrix of all possible permutations of five elements, you know, so that... You know, and
you can get hung up in that sort of thing.
Yeah, and all the harmonic structures were symmetrical because, you know, I had the geometry of the piano keyboard with its repeating 12-note thing, and then the bilateral symmetry of the human body and the hands and all this stuff. I finally drew the double bar and said, to hell with this. And from that point on, all the pieces I did were theater pieces, many of them dealing with authoritarian political systems and, you know, control systems. So starting about 81, I started doing almost exclusively theatrical pieces. The first one of those that I did of any substance was called Extract, and that was during my Italian Futurist period. I had just really discovered modernism and, you know, the sort of the early avant-gardes of the various European countries. And even though politically I didn't quite see eye to eye with Marinetti and his crowd, I liked their aesthetics. You know, it was very technological. And I was being very technologically oriented in pretty much everything I did, even if it was not on the surface about technology. There was something that was driving the process and even, in some cases, the content. You know, like with the piano piece, the idea of having a robot as a theatrical conceit. Extract was a theater piece in which there was a figure I called the Oracle. And the person who performed that role was Phil Larson, who's pretty well known as a bass baritone in music circles. He works a lot with Roger Reynolds, and he's on the faculty at UCSD. I had him completely wrapped in aluminum foil with a tape deck on his lap, headphones, and he was surrounded by four microphones on big studio stands. So he was up on a little dais, and he had this sort of cage of microphones. Then marked out on the floor was this large arrow pointing from him down to a pedestal at the other end of the room with another tape deck. Then I had four attendants dressed in white and three other characters dressed in black, and the attendants were dancers, and they moved in a kind of automaton-like fashion and interacted directly with the Oracle while they were making their approach, and they were moving through a field of projected text.
Okay.
And I had various texts from various sources. While they were doing that, the other three characters in black who behaved in a very militaristic fashion, would come up to a microphone and read texts in a variety of languages that had to do with such things as interrogation, confession, oracular divination, these sorts of things. I used texts from as far back as the Delphic Oracle, actually in classic Greek. I had a text in French about the role of the Inquisitor during the Inquisition. I had texts about the sacrament of confession. I had texts about criminal interrogation. I had texts about criminal interrogation. And they were mostly in the form of questions, so they were lists of questions. So they were questions about questioning. That was heard through the headphones by the oracle, and the oracle would mimic the sound but not the sense of what was heard.
Okay.
That went into the microphones and was heard out into the space. And all the while, you've got this tape recorder going on his lap. When the attendants finally reached him, they then unthreaded the end of the tape and pulled it in slow motion down along the big arrow on the floor, threaded it up to the other tape deck, and started it. And then you could hear a voice. While they were doing it in slow motion, you heard this sort of growly slow motion voice. And then when they started it, you heard a very lovely woman's voice, sort of like Laurie Anderson's speaking voice. You know, it has this great warmth, this kind of motherly thing. But reading a text from Marinetti in which he's saying that wings are asleep in the flesh of man. And then at the end, the oracle rises up and, you know, his soul. Ritualistic close. Now, I was explaining this piece to a friend of mine while I was working on it. Now, this is a piece that came to me in a vision while I was sitting in a graduate seminar. This would happen to me a lot, you know. either there was something really interesting in the seminar,
or
I'd be really bored, you know. So I'd be sort of sitting there, you know, to write notes. And I was sitting, it was Pauline's seminar in theater pieces and collaboration. And I just had this image of this tape being pulled out. And so I'm telling my friend about the whole thing. He said, well, you know what you're describing is actually the functioning of a tape recorder. Because you've got a signal going in and it's, you know, it's being received by this recording head stack. And then later it's being played back by the same system. And in fact, the tape went left to right, just like on a tape recorder, and there was a certain amount of rotary movement on the part of the attendants. They would, you know, walk slowly in a circle, and it was the same way that the supply reel would go. So actually what I had done was to take my working environment of the studio. I spent a lot of hours hunched over a tape deck,
right.
And I'd use this as a model of, you know, the structure of the piece, the dramatic and the staging elements of the piece. So, you know, as soon as I realized this, that gave me another methodology to use consciously, because it was strictly, you know, an intuitive thing. And so I began to become a lot more acutely aware of how I was generating material, manipulating material. What were my own motivations? And this was actually an important part of the education that I was receiving. In fact, in Roger Reynolds' compositional seminar that I took in my first year, one of the things that stuck with me is he said, the important thing is to learn how to perform yourself. And, you know, this is a critical thing for any composer, any creative artist.
So
how do you,
he was speaking metaphorically then? He didn't mean that you should be able to play everything to your right?
No. To perform yourself being
the object.
Oh,
I got it. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
You know?
Yes.
You know, how do you kickstart your own creative process? You know, how do you get past that blank page syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did focus a lot of attention on that. And with an increasing degree of attention, because, you know, I would discover things about how I worked or where I got things from,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I reached back into childhood to discover some of these things. And a lot of my breakthrough experiences also came in that class of Pauline's. In fact, our final for that class was one day Pauline said, well, you know, it's almost the end of term. What do you want to do for a final exam? And in those days, she was doing cheap commissions at the local flea market in Leucadia, where she'd set up a booth and people would give her whatever they had, and she'd write them a piece. So we decided to commission a piece from Pauline. So we took all the change out of our pocket, slid it up the seminar table, you know. And so she came in with a piece, and it alternated playing with various, you know, blocks and, you know, little kid toys and meditations. And during one of the meditations, I realized I spent a lot of time playing with Tinker Toys. And I was thinking about the way I was structuring pieces, and rather than having things that are sort of through composed, you know, generative process, mm-hmm. you know, big melody kind of things,
yep.
I was taking chunks of stuff and sticking them together. I would take a length of this and a length of that,
right.
And then I'd have a joint.
Yep.
And, you know, and I realized that a lot of my formal ideas were, you know, really based on, you know, early play behaviors and the materials I was using to play with. I was also doing sculpture and things like that as a kid, you know, just playing with plasticine clay. So a lot of things that I would do in manipulating material was also kind of warping and stretching and smoothing out and this and that. So, you know, that became a real, it was an epiphany of sorts. And it helped to guide me in future pieces. So that led naturally into a series of other works when I was finishing up my doctoral degree.
And this was where?
This is still at UCSD.
Okay,
I was there 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I started doing pieces. Well, I did one piece that was based on a place and on the characteristics of the place. And that was a piece called Nocturne 2 that was created to be performed in a gallery downtown San Diego. Now, this was a place that was very reverberant and that had a particular, it was kind of a shoebox divided down its long axis by a wall that went up 8 feet with a 12-foot ceiling.
Okay, yeah.
And the main gallery space was in the larger part of that, and then the other side of the wall was the artist's own studio. And I used the reverberant quality and said, well, I'm going to do something about echoes and resonances, and I'm going to do something with shadows and repetition. And I used this basic sort of core idea of the echo, and I took it in a lot of different directions. And I also took the architecture of the space, and I used that as my scenographic, you know, armature. And I did an 8-channel surround sound system that was performed by a friend of mine who was very good at that sort of thing. Nicolas Varin is a composer in Paris. I used, you know, some lighting effects, but it was mostly a very dark piece, and I used texts on tape that related to echoes and shadows and came from classic Greek literature, so that I had, for instance, the myth of Echo from Ovid's Metamorphoses.
Yep.
And I did a Steve Reich come-out thing with that, where I had this little girl voice on two tracks, and then gradually split them. And as they were splitting in time, you know, as one was dragging behind the other, they were also moving in space.
Uh-huh.
And I had my friend move the thing all through the 8 channels around. And then I also used the allegory of the cave from Plato's Republic, and I had, you know, the 4 echoes of that. And while that was going on, I had shadows being cast on the ceiling of various objects that had been used during the piece, a trombone, a flute, you know, roller skate. I had things in the piece like roller skating flute players.
Gee, that's
a good image there.
Yes.
I'm sure that's been used elsewhere. But,
well, tap-dancing flute.
Thank you. Brush yourself. Brush yourself.
Bonjour. My name is Richard Zvonar, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one-stop for non-pop, or your red alert for new music, or something equally inventive, on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR Plainfield. They always come up with these inventive things.
They do.
Why do they always say that?
Nice to see that he hasn't lost his French accent.
Our guest indeed is Richard Zvonar here on WGDR Plainfield.
And what did we just hear that was the merest non sequitur from what he was talking about?
His piece Highway Jelly, performed by a group called, well, I'm not sure if it's the group is B108 or the group is Clang, but it says Clang and B108 on it. So, and that's about all. Mm-hmm. Salamander Songs. And it's not available
in stores.
In stores. For good reason. Before that, there was a long piece, and that was the piece he was, in fact, talking about at the time, which is 3-4-5. Little ensemble playing that there. Well, we should make a few mentions before we go back to the interview itself. Next week, Mark Trail is our guest. Mark Trail, the pseudonymous Mark Trail.
Not the roto-comic.
Not the roto-comic, no. Roto-comic.
Roto-comic.
Gosh, do they still have rotogravures?
I wonder. I hope so. Mm.
And after that, June 5th, Elma Mayer and Brian Woodbury. I'll be gone for that one, but you'll be here.
With Brian and Elma.
Elma, yes. And I forget who's coming up after that. It'll be a lot of fun. Next week will be fun. It'll also be our first show of our 10th year on the air. 10th and last. I keep saying that, hoping that people will say, oh, please, you must stay.
Here's compensation.
Yes, here's a big wheelbarrow full of green things that aren't broccoli. Anyway, that's next week. And Discovery Channel will be here filming what we do, which you folks out in Radio Land won't be able to see, I'm so happy to say. We could be making it up and you wouldn't know. All right, shall we go back?
But they'll have to do a station ID.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we can get them all to collaborate on a station ID.
Indeed.
And they won't have to say anything unusual and different, because they will sound that way. California.
Roller skating for the players. Well,
yeah, that was nice because, you know, the audience was in two groups, and I had the skaters could move around in two circles, or they could do figure eights. And they were doing little, just little snippets, little licks that would sort of interact. And that was a piece that, for one, it was drawing on a particular physical reality, which was the nature of this space, which was problematic because it's so reverberant. So I just decided I'd use that. And the other thing is to take a kind of a core idea, a concept, and then realize it through a number of different media, a number of different methodologies. I was using literary manifestations, acoustical manifestations, graphic elements, that sort of thing. And that was kind of prepping me for the big piece, which was my dissertation piece. And that was based on a book. It was Soul Murder. The book that got me started on it was of that title by Dr. Morton Schatzman, who's an American psychiatrist living in London. And he had done a study of the book Memoirs of My Nervous Illness by Dr. Daniel Paul Schreiber, the celebrated schizophrenic German judge, circa 1900. And in the context of Schreiber's upbringing, his father was a noted orthopedist who used to invent things to correct postural problems, mm-hmm. and he tried them out on his own kids.
Ow.
So, if you slunched over the table while doing your homework, well, you'd have this thing that would thrust your shoulders back and you'd keep this, erect Teutonic posture.
Uncomfortable just remembering and seeing those pictures.
Yeah, and there were books that Schreber published of exercises. He had this little home exercise machine that you could use. It was a sort of combination of some stirrups and some hoops that you would pull up on. And there were the pictures of these little guys doing the exercises. So what happened was his son, Daniel Paul, became a judge. But at the moment when he was really starting to rise in his career, he clutched and he went crazy and he was hospitalized. And he became convinced that God was afflicting him with rays that were attaching to his nervous system, injecting his body with the nerve language, and that also he was sending down these fleetingly improvised men, who were these little guys who would come down and torment him. They would squeeze his head together in the head compressing machine and you know, they had all of these hard devices.
St. Simon's Hospital for the Criminally
Insane. Yeah. And the main purpose of all of this was to transform him into a woman.
Uh-huh.
So that he could become the mother of the new race after the general devastation. Okay. Now, analysis of this by various people, in court, including Schatzman, is, well, the guy couldn't live up to his father's example. He couldn't become the father. So the only thing left for him was to become the mother.
Wow, what a terrific concept.
Now, Freud did an analysis of him. It's available. He never actually met Schreber, but he felt that he had the book that Schreber had written, and the words of the patient are enough. You don't actually need to meet the patient. So he did an analysis. But for many years, Freud's analysis was the one that people were going by. And they were discounting the actual realities of the torture that these kids were experiencing growing up. You know, I think a couple of his siblings committed suicide, and you know, so it was a real dysfunctional family. So what I did with that was I took the book, Schatzman's book, I took Schreber's original book, I used those as sources of text and sources of visual text. So I would shoot slides of pages of the book. Yeah. Illustrations. I found an edition of one of the original exercise books with the little men, and then I went out from there and I took the basic idea of control and isolation and I went into areas of cybernetics. Information science, kinesiology, structural linguistics, you know, all of these areas that had to do with control systems and analysis, especially analysis of language. You know, because we're talking about the nerve language mm-hmm. and the transformations that are taking place in terminology where, you know, Schreber is thinking about the nerve language and some of the things that are being injected into him are actually transformations of terminology that his father had used. And there were examples in the Schatzman analysis. Of, he'd go back to the father's writing and say, he says this, and then, you know, his son says this.
So how are you?
is this.
So how are you transforming all this?
Well, some of the things that I did, you know, one thing in particular.
Yeah, it's just so ambitious.
Yeah, it was a big piece. It was about 45 minutes long. Uh-huh. And one example is the thing about the text where an original text is kind of a template for the new text. There's a sort of transform of the imagery contained in the original text mm-hmm. into the new. You know, the way I did that was, first I did a little riff on nerve language, and I deconstructed the text on the computer. Now, this is 82, and we didn't have a lot of fancy, you know, computer graphics programs then. I just used the VI text editor, mm-hmm. and I took a text, and I created a series of versions of it where I would delete different classes of phonetic material so okay. that, yeah. You know, first I would delete all the letters E and then I and, you know, work down through the vowels and then through different classes of consonants. So, you know, I'd take stop consonants out and then, you know, I'd be left with just fricatives and punctuation and then all the fricatives went out and you said punctuation, it looked like a little star field and then gone. So, and I shot each one of those, you know, on 35 millimeter mm-hmm. slide film. And then I would project them in reverse order. So you had the coalescence
okay. yep.
of this block of text. Then I just did a dissolve to the other text. Then I had my little performers, one of whom, by the way, was Brian Woodbury, who's coming in next. Elma was on projector. They came out with these little blank cards on poles. So there was a card that was a rectangular, you know, maybe 8 inches to a foot wide, and on these very long poles. And they come out and they would raise the poles up into the projected field of the text and pull out individual words. So it was kind of like, this is before refrigerator magnet poetry, but it was that sort of thing. You know, because I was, one of the things that I was really interested in was concrete poetry and sound poetry. So I was using in my projections of a lot of text, I was using ideas that I'd pulled from the world of concrete poetry. So, you know, this was one little section of the piece in which, you know, text was being manipulated in various ways. You know, the one thing is the coalescence of a text and transformation of one text into another, and then the excerpting of elements of a text to make new texts. Now, while this is going on as the visual and theatrical element, I've got my voice heavily processed in a four-track playback, and I did the same sort of thing with the voice that I did with the text, in that I used gating, mm-hmm. and I started out where you would hear just all the little fricative sounds and all the stops, you know, so you had this and then gradually I'd let in other elements of the sound. So then that would gradually coalesce mm-hmm. into the running text. And it also spread it out spatially because I would have vowels. You know, I had two layers. I had the high-pitched ones and then all of the deeper vocalic sounds, heavily reverberated, were creating a kind of drum track
okay.
at the bottom.
Yep.
So, you know, so I had these two parallel processes going on that were based on the same idea of fragmentation and reconstruction. Other things throughout the piece. Well, you know, one of the main elements of the piece was that it was a multiple slide projector, you know, visual system.
All of the material tossed in here in yeah. terms of media.
Yeah, yeah. With mobile screens. I had a set of three projection screens that were on casters. And the screens, two of the screens were 8 feet tall and 12 feet wide, and the other one was 8x8. And there were four different configurations of these throughout the piece. So at key moments in the piece, the things would change position. So, you know, I'd start out with a kind of triptych arrangement, front projection on all three of these. Mm-hmm. And there'd be space in between the three, and performers could come and go from the space. Then later on, the middle one went away, and its side two pulled in and formed a kind of, it was a section called the Four Courts of Heaven, and I had a set of exercises being done by my four performers. And they were exercises based on the exercises from Schreber's text, and the projected images were the images from the text that went along with that. And then there was a very massive sound that accompanied the moving forward of these screens to form a wall right practically in the laps of the front row. And I had bricks projected on them, so there's this big, heavy brick wall. Mm-hmm. It was kind of an Edgar Allan Poe Hitting the Pendulum reference of this big, heavy wall bearing down on you. And then the center screen was actually two layers. It was a photo backdrop paper covering over a rear projection screen. So I had a performer come out and tore off the front layer in strips until it now became a rear projection screen. And then we had a little mirror play where I had two performers that had very similar body types, so their silhouettes would match. And I had them doing slowed down versions of the exercises. And at first you just saw what looked like this single silhouette. And then gradually things would go out of sync, or people would go asymmetric to each other. And so that was this very slow lyrical passage with a lot of breath sound. So those are the sorts of things that the piece was based on. Having an environment that was both surround sound, because I had a six-channel surround system, and also it was a black box theater. And with a fairly high ceiling and grid, and you had a kind of environmental surround in the visual elements of the piece. And then there are all of these different networks of association between different manifestations of the same underlying concept. So if you have the image of cutting, which I used a lot. I had scissors. You know, do you know the Struwwel, Peter? It's an old German book of. Now no. You mustn't suck your thumb.
No, don't know that at all.
Oh well, there's one. You know, I'm going out now, and if you suck your thumb, the tailor's going to come and cut your thumbs off. You know, so I used that poem, and I had the image of scissors, and the idea of cutting as being a physical manifestation of the idea of separation. These things would be used in different ways in the piece. You'd have physical images of scissors, and I used actual scissors, and I had projected images of scissors. I had also had projected images of hands, and I had hands with and without thumbs, you know. And then you'd also have, a book from a Noam Chomsky book on structural linguistics, where you have all these sentence diagrams, where you're taking language and you're cutting it up into its constituent elements, and then attaching it together with these lines, and the lines are like the rays of the nerve language, you know. So God sending that down rays.
You know.
So it's very, very complex. You know, one reviewer said it was Joycean. You know, and that's kind of the idea, that you're building up this very dense, very complex environment of images and ideas, and most of it's going to go right over people's heads.
It's in real time. Unlike Joyce, you can't review unless you go back to see it again.
Right. Which became possible after I was out of school. We did a 3-week run of it, so we had 3 or 4 performances a week. And some people were able to come back and see it multiple times. I don't know how many did it, but...
And this is when?
This was early 80s.
Is it possible that during this chat that we've had, we could sample any of the sound portion of it?
We will drop some of what we can into the broadcast. So.
Yes. Yeah. I can provide you with some examples. I don't have any right handy, but I've got all the tapes, and you know, I've been meaning to digitize them anyway.
We have to consider this a part one.
Well, we've probably run on for a bit. What's the time now?
Just almost an hour.
It's an hour. So, yeah, we're about at the end of our broadcast for this. And so we'll consider it a part one. We'll come grab you again.
Okay.
And take you from the 80s to the present and finally catch you up.
Yeah. Well, I'd say that the more interesting work is already in this part, but... No, I've done some things since, but I haven't done anything as ambitious as that. God, we didn't even talk about Diamanda.
No, we haven't, and we will save that.
That's more part two.
For next time, for part two. Our guest today was Richard Zvonar, and we're leaving.
Oh yes,
and we'll be back next time with part two of the interview that'll take us to the last 15 years,
or maybe even beyond by that time. And beyond that time.
And beyond. Richard Zvonar, our guest, for the first portion of his compositional life, and we'll bring him back. I think Laurie Spiegel and Clarence Barlow were the others who took hours and hours to regale us with their work and lives.
Regale, there's an interesting term, sure.
Well, you didn't think this was regulatory?
Well, I
regulacious?
It was
regulacious!
That's it.
It was a regulacious event.
Just lost focus once in a while.
Yeah, but that's not unusual.
Oh, no. Comes with the territory.
Reminder, Mark Trails, our guest next week and the week after, Elma Mayer and Brian Woodbury. Join us next week. We'll have Marco Opedisano will be here. He's going to be in studio with us also as a co-host for next week's show. He was a guest a couple of months ago, so he'll be here, and we'll have a lot of fun. Discovery Channel will be here and filming away.
And maybe we can reprise your tune here.
Well, that's the day after, so we can't exactly reprise it.
Yes, we can.
Oh, we'll see what happens.
We can do that.
It'll be a lot of fun. That's the beginning of our 10th year, so you can welcome to call in next week.
And send food
and flowers.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And, you know, all those things that we... here at the station absolutely love.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Footwear. Till next week, and Mark Trail, this is the conclusion of Two in the Hand by Richard Zvonar. Thank you.
A production of Baltic Media.